Good evening, and welcome to the Athenaeum. It's so good to start recognizing faces in the crowd. I'm Beth Hessel, the Executive Director of the Athenaeum. I'm in my fourth month here. So for those of you who have been members for 30 or 40 or 50 years, I look forward to getting to know you in the coming days and months. If you are a visitor here, please raise your hand. I'd love to see. We have a few people who are visiting. It's so wonderful to have you here. I hope you find tonight a stimulating time with our book talk and with the reception to follow, and that you will consider joining everyone else here as members of the Athenaeum. I wanted to share with you all, you get to be the first to see this. Last night, several of our board members and I were in New York City in the Rainbow Room. Have you been to the Rainbow Room? It's exquisite. For the annual gala of the Sir John Soane Museum Foundation. Now raise your hand. I'm having you raise your hand. If you've been to the Sir John Soane Museum, raise your hand. Okay, I want to join you someday soon in doing that. The foundation is here in New York City raising money to support the Sir John Soane Museum in London. Every year at their gala, they honor an architect or architectural firm and also an institution that is known for its architectural excellence. This year, the Athenaeum was the honoree. If you have not taken a visit to the wonders of our architectural archives, I encourage you to reach out to Bruce Laverty, our curator, who is not here tonight, he's on vacation today, but to reach out to him and make an appointment to come and see some of those wonderful things we have in the collection, as well as to look at our exhibit below on Louis Magaziner. But after, I will have this on hand so you can come up and see our beautiful medal, which we have to figure out how we will show. As we speak about architecture, I don't know if that is immediately what comes to mind with Janie Scott, and many of you probably know her from her previous work, if not this, as a longtime reporter for the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, where she participated in some award-winning reporting on race and class demographics in the United States. After 9/11, she wrote thousands of thumbnail sketches and profiles of the victims of 9/11 that were published there. She also wrote a wonderful biography of Barack Obama's mother. She brought that same sensitive lens to her most latest book, The Beneficiary, which tells of the architecture, literal and emotional, of her own family through their homes and their dreams and their hopes. And so it is with a great delight that we at the Athenaeum, who have such a strong interest in the history of Philadelphia and the people of Philadelphia, to have Janie here tonight to speak about and read from her book, and afterwards to answer questions from all of us. So I invite you to welcome Janie Scott.
Thank you very much, Beth. Thank you to the Athenaeum for having me here, and to all of you for coming. I actually did a little bit of the research for this book in this building and was completely captivated by the place. I envy Beth getting to work here. It's not easy to talk about your own book. You spend years puzzling in solitude over how to say precisely what you want to say, nothing less and certainly nothing more. And then there you are, attempting to sum it all up in a half hour or 45 minutes in public, in midair, and without a net. Plus, there's another problem. Maybe you saw the book review in the New York Times a couple months ago that quoted Philip Larkin declining his publisher's invitation to go out and flog his latest book of poems. Larkin wrote to Faber and Faber, "Unless one is extremely impressive in the flesh, one gets more dividends out of keeping out of sight, as people's imaginary picture of you is always so much more flattering than the reality." The Beneficiary is a family memoir of sorts. It's part social history, part detective story, part a tale of a waning class. Its focus becomes, as the story takes shape, my charming, accomplished, enigmatic father. It's something perhaps some of you have considered doing or have even done, a child's quest to make sense of a captivating but opaque parent and of the family that shaped them both. I'm aware that some of you probably know or knew at least some of the people in my book. No doubt you know things that, at least some of you know things that I do not know or couldn't have known. The book is not a biography, and it's not a family history, nor is it fiction. It's one child's memoir, mixing historical research and journalism and personal memory, not to sentimentalize or romanticize, but to try to understand some of what I had glimpsed. The book spans roughly a century and three generations in my father's family, Montgomery's, Scott's, and Wheeler's. It begins with his death in 2005 at age 76 from cirrhosis of the liver, then lurches back roughly 100 years to try to unearth the story of Ardrossan, the once roughly 800-acre British-style country estate in Villanova, where by the time I was a child in the 50s and 60s, four generations of my father's family were ensconced. As some of you may know, that place lasted largely intact from one gilded age to the next, outlasting just about every other one of the dozens of estates of its kind, if not exactly its scale, all of them made possible by the extraordinary wealth that churned out of Philadelphia in its industrial heyday, spilling westward from the city through those prosperous suburban towns that came to be known from the railroad tracks that connected them as the main line. Ardrossan was, and to some extent remains, an extraordinarily beautiful place. Rolling meadows and pastures, fields of corn and alfalfa, threaded with creeks and streams and punctuated by woods. Until the last years of the 20th century, one could ramble the mile and a half distance from one end of Ardrossan to the other and cross just one public road. Ardrossan survived as long as it did, I now know, in part through clever tax planning by my father's grandparents, Robert Leeming Montgomery and Charlotte Hope Binney Tyler Montgomery, who built the place in the years leading up to and immediately after World War I, and, along with her father, locked it all up in trusts. It lasted too, at least in part, through the force of personality and will of their eldest child, Helen Hope Montgomery Scott, my father's mother, who, for much of her adult life, was reputed to have been the inspiration or the model for the character of Tracy Lord, the spoiled mainline heiress who gets her comeuppance in the course of the Philadelphia story, the 1939 play by Philip Barry that became one of the most successful American films of the 20th century. I'm going to read a short passage from the beginning of the book that introduces Ardrossan, the house, and the place kind of as a character in the book. In the origin stories, my father's grandfather was the great progenitor. It was said that he'd fallen from a horse on a hilltop in a section of Radnor Township, then called Villa Nova, while fox hunting sometime around the turn of the 20th century. He was knocked unconscious, the story went, but promptly recovered. Coming to, he found himself captivated by the spot, with its 360-degree views of farmland dotted with houses and barns. He resolved to buy the land and build a house to match the scale of his ambition. He was a young investment banker, present at the birth of a new era in the country's industrialization. He'd made a propitious marriage to the daughter of a wealthy, well-connected Philadelphia banker. So he hired the go-to architect to plutocrats of the day. He named the estate Ardrossan, after a town and a castle in southwestern Scotland left behind by his ancestors. He installed 9 Ayrshire cows, imported from Scotland, in his dairy barn, and 7 mares and a prize-winning stallion from Ireland in his broodmare stables. He hired young immigrants, newly arrived from Sweden, Ireland, Switzerland, and France, to milk his cows, mow his meadows, drive his cars, clean his house, cook and serve meals for his growing family. And annexing surrounding farms, he soon presided over some 800 acres. With the help of French governesses, he and his wife brought up 4 children in the house. 3 of the children married, moved into houses on the property, and reared children of their own, who, in turn, followed suit. By the early 1950s, there were 4 generations of my father's family living on an estate roughly the size of Central Park, located a half hour's drive from the center of the 4th largest city in the country. It was a 19th century British estate plucked from the pages of Jane Austen or Henry James, floated across the Atlantic, and wedged in among the swimming pools of John Updike and John Cheever. The place, which is what family members called it, applying the blandest of generics to something increasingly sui generis, comprised dozens of houses, a half dozen barns, stables, carriage houses, garages, silos, an ice house, a root cellar, several swimming pools, tennis courts, a kennel, and a couple of one-room schoolhouses, in one of which my grandfather, an aspiring playwright for a time, had labored over the only play of his that I'm told he ever got produced. The run is said to have lasted 3 nights. By the time I was born, the great progenitor was dead. Every winter, my widowed, white-haired great-grandmother disappeared for several months to a former rice plantation near Georgetown, South Carolina. I now know that my father's grandparents had bought that place in the early 1930s, in the throes of the Great Depression, at a time when rich Northerners were buying up former rice plantations for use as shooting retreats. With a wealthy Northerner friend, my great-grandfather, known in the family as the Colonel, dispatched the owner of a Georgetown fish house to Russia for a crash course in caviar production. For years, when I was a child, cases of homegrown caviar from sturgeon in the Great PD River, packed in ball jars, would arrive at houses on Ardrossan. My parents kept theirs in the freezer, in the pantry, next to the popsicles, to be taken out and thawed on special occasions, then served on rectangles of toasted Arnold's Hearthstone White. My father's mother, Helen Hope, was the dominant figure on the place when I was young, and to a large extent, the magnet that held it intact for half a century. Socialite, horsewoman, fashion plate, dairy farmer, with a vast repertoire of racy jokes, she was said to have bought a horse from a friend for a pound of caviar and a dirty story every week for a year. After her father's death, she'd taken control of his then neglected dairy herd, though she said she didn't know the difference between a laxative and lactation, and built the herd into what for a time was the highest producing Ayrshire herd of its size in the country. Her husband, Edgar Scott, was a grandson of Thomas Alexander Scott, who'd been vice president and then president of the Pennsylvania Railroad when it was the largest freight carrier in the world and the most profitable corporation in North America. Charming, well-educated, literary, urbane, Edgar Scott had studied playwriting at Harvard, where he'd met Philip Barry, who became a regular visitor to Ardrossan. When the Philadelphia Story opened on Broadway in 1939, the setting bore a striking resemblance to Ardrossan. The financier father, the preposterous magnitude of the house, the swimming pool and the grove of trees, etc., etc. The movie, starring Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant, became an American classic. And over the years, it came to be said that Helen Hope was the original Tracy Lord. To the extent that my grandmother had doubts about whether that was exactly true, and she did, she mostly kept them to herself. My uncle, the third of 4 Edgars, told me she started to value the importance of being Mrs. Philadelphia's Story. When she died in 1995 at 91, after being knocked down by her pet donkeys, her local celebrity was such that the Philadelphia Inquirer stripped her obituary across the top of the front page. The headline was roughly the size they used a few years later for the death of the Pope. My father, Robert Montgomery Scott, was the second of the two sons of Hope and Edgar. He had grown up on the place. He returned there after college. He went to the law school his great uncle had attended and joined the firm that his great uncle had co-founded. And he lived on the place in a house two fields away from his parents for the rest of his life, except for 4 years in London as special assistant to the United States ambassador to the court of St. James, Walter Annenberg, the publishing billionaire. My father had inherited his mother's charisma, his father's charm and literary interests, and a sensitivity to music and the arts, the latter in part through the influence of his mother's musical and artistic sister, Mary Binney, who studied piano at the Curtis Institute of Music, performed at Carnegie Hall, had not one but two love affairs with Leopold Stokowski, the conductor and music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra, founded and ran a dance company, adopted two daughters as an unmarried woman in the 1940s, and spent much of the last third of her life traveling in India and Sri Lanka, creating some 9,000 photographic images of life in South Asia, which are now housed at the University of Pennsylvania, where my father's beloved aunt, Mary Binney Montgomery Wheeler, is described as the last in a long line of romantic, artistic, and literary travelers, true adventurers of the human spirit, seeking to discover and unlock the mystique of faraway lands. My father, some of you I'm imagining knew him or met him, was intelligent, generous, public-spirited, and great fun. His Thanksgiving feasts at Ardrossan on the Friday after Thanksgiving in the final decade of his life were unforgettable. A guest list of nearly 100 family members and friends, infants to octogenarians, and to shepherd everyone to the tables, a bagpiper in kilt, sparren, and clan accessories. Over the years, he devoted increasing amounts of his talents and energy to civic and cultural institutions in Philadelphia, including 7 years as president of the Academy of Music and 14 years as president and CEO of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, during which time attendance ballooned, the endowment increased fivefold, and he oversaw a turnaround in operations. When he retired in the mid-90s, a columnist in Philadelphia called him admiringly a traitor to his class, that is, the rare Philadelphia patrician for whom the anti-leadership vaccine, identified by E. Digby Baltzell, the University of Pennsylvania sociologist of the once ruling elite, had failed to take. His style as a parent was less pedagogical than Pied Piper. He addressed his children as troops, summoning us to muster with a hunting horn blast. He led us on expeditions, organized bicycle outings and boat trips. As I wrote in the book, later, he refrained from offering unsolicited career advice. He never presumed to understand our work. He might, however, let you know, after you were already married, that it would be okay to bail if you concluded you'd made a serious mistake. My father was also, as I said, an enigma. He had many, many acquaintances, but by his own admission, few, if any, close friends. There was a side of him that was very closed, his cousin Mike Kennedy told me. I wonder how many people really did know him. When I was a child, he occasionally referred opaquely to the black dog, a term I now know Winston Churchill used for his periods of deep depression. He sometimes predicted he would be dead by 50, which seemed surprising since his parents were showing no signs of flagging two fields away. He drank heavily almost his entire life, having begun in adolescence, and in the end it killed him. Before it did, he did a curious thing. My father, who had never lived in what was called the big house at Ardrossan, big being 50 rooms, spent what would prove to be the last decade of his life restoring to mint condition much of that house, at his own expense, a house he didn't own. When my parents' marriage had ended after 42 years, he'd moved into the third floor nursery in the big house where his mother and her siblings had grown up and had turned it into an apartment for himself. Then he turned his attention to the ground floor and restored every one of those then dilapidated public rooms with all the attention to quality and detail you might expect from a curator of period rooms at the Philadelphia Museum. He replaced the roof for what he said it had cost his grandparents to build the entire house. He sent the ballroom rug across the Atlantic for rehabilitation. He had furniture dismantled down to its bones, rebuilt and reupholstered, oak paneling treated, wood carvings renewed, original textiles meticulously copied, draperies reproduced. Then he died. I became interested in writing about the world of Ardrossan some years after my father's death. I'd spent the first 14 years of my life in that place, living with my parents and my sister and brother in a fieldstone house with a date stone going back to the 1700s. Ardrossan had been an idyllic place to be a child, but I'd spent my entire adult life elsewhere, working as a newspaper reporter in Massachusetts, New Jersey, California, New York, living in cities and in apartments that, needless to say, did not have 9 bathrooms. In the aftermath of my father's death, I'd become aware that there existed a large collection of family papers going back 100 to 150 years that had drifted into an ironing room in a back wing of the big house. I'd finished an earlier book, and I thought I had some time. I would go and see what was there. Turned out to be a large but somewhat random collection of papers, everything from scrapbooks and photo albums to diaries and invoices and lots of personal correspondence. And over a period of months of plowing my way through all that, I began to think it would be possible to piece together from that material and following various threads wherever it led me, how that place had come about and what had happened over time. It also occurred to me that if I could excavate the story of the world that had shaped my father, I might come to understand him better. And I might come to understand more about how his seemingly charmed life had arrived at, to me, its perplexing end. I'd been fascinated by my father from my earliest years. He'd never seemed, at least to me, quite like other fathers I knew. He'd acquired a pack of beagles that he housed in a cinder block kennel on the place, and that he hunted on weekends in the fall and winter in the open countryside to the west. My sister and brother and I grew up spending many Sundays trailing behind him and his pack, along with a band of hardy, enthusiastic beaglers. Later, he took up long-distance cycling. Before it was as popular as it is today, he cycled extensively in England, Scotland, Ireland, New Zealand, and China. In his 60s, and drinking heavily every night, he sometimes covered 100 miles a day. I accompanied him on several of those trips in my 20s. On a 3-week biking trip through China, he congratulated himself privately on having purposefully shed the strongest younger cyclists, largely to show that fat old men can do it too. Defying our Chinese minders, this was 1982, he woke me at dawn for an unauthorized spin through the back streets of Guangzhou. In a restaurant, facing down a dreary so-called Western lunch, he charmed a young Chinese guide into sharing her pig's intestines with him. For a man who'd planted himself in a single corner of southeastern Pennsylvania for nearly all of his life, as I wrote in the book, he sometimes seemed to me happiest on an unknown road in an undiscovered country with his bicycling companions, if any, a half mile behind. After one of those trips, he told me, out of the blue, that he wanted me to have his journals when he died. It was no secret that he kept them. We'd all seen him doing it. And I was, of course, fascinated by the possibility of seeing them and enormously flattered. So I said, well, why me? He said, you're the writer, and left it at that. That was the extent of the conversation. I never dared bring it up again, not because I forgot about it, which I certainly didn't, but I was afraid that he'd either change his mind or I'd seem to be eagerly awaiting his demise. So when he died, the journals were nowhere to be found among his possessions in the apartment that he built on the top of the big house. Some years later, when I got interested in doing this book, I tried to find them, tried several other sources, managed to track down a handful of small diaries from various trips, but nothing else. I couldn't understand why he would have destroyed everything else and kept those, or why those would be the only ones that I would have access to. But I gave up, and I was deep into the writing of the third chapter of this book when I stumbled upon a single volume in the bottom of a box of letters in the basement of my mother's house, the house my father had left 20 years before. That volume, just a handful of entries by my father in his mid-20s, was to me a revelation. I realized at that moment I had to search the whole of my mother's house. It had never occurred to me that he might have left them there, as I say, the place he had left 20 years earlier. I returned several weeks later and went from the basement to the back parts of the third floor, checking every room and every closet. And in the very last place I had to look, a large walk-in closet on the third floor, I noticed a large wooden chest with a padlock on it, pushed into a corner, something I thought I'd never seen before, and it was somewhat obscured by cardboard boxes. When I approached and moved the boxes out of the way, I noticed that the padlock had been left at one digit off from the last four digits of my parents' phone number, the number they'd always used for combination locks. So it seemed kind of obvious what I was supposed to do. I turned the dial one digit, the lock popped open, I pulled the chest out, and there were 40 years worth of diaries in identical black three-ring binders, all organized chronologically, seemingly waiting to be discovered. I'm going to read a passage from that first diary that I found in that box of letters, the one that I just described as revelatory. I take my diary down from the shelf and I begin to write when I am in moods of reappraisal and reform. Judging from the dates of the entries in this volume, the moods are becoming less frequent, but their sensible intensity does not seem to have diminished. Formerly, the moods were short, a day or two of depression or elation, and the episode soon forgotten. This time, it has been much longer. For almost 3 weeks now, the mood and I have been cohabiting rather regularly. Perhaps it's the influence of vacation. The urge to create for the satisfaction of creating, runs strong during these moods. I would try to write a novel, perhaps built on a projection of my grandfather Montgomery's life. Since I've never tried to write, and never had any reason to believe I had any ability to do so, I read instead. The reading slowly stimulates the urge to write. Tonight, my first preoccupation is that I feel enormously dull. Aiming to please, I am first upset by the fact that I am and have for a long time been unable to dredge up topics of conversation, am unable to amuse. I am also dull to myself. I know within myself that I am not only uninteresting, but uninterested. I am dull to other people and to myself because there is very little other than myself that I care about. There is nothing which I find exciting, stimulating, except things which I do alone, unanalyzed and unspoken. Work, perhaps, beagling, reading, drinking, perhaps. I am cold in the sense of being dead to so much. Short in values and interests, my horizon is illumined by the glow of human admiration. Without that glow, I am undirected. I am now 26 years old. I live in a beautiful formal house with grounds which I cannot afford to keep on a decaying quasi-baronial domain of great beauty in an encroaching suburb. I am a graduate of a law school and paid to practice law by a rather good, stuffy law firm, and I am quite mediocre about it. I am married to a charming wife with whom I have little in common but background. My failure at the tennis court eliminated what she felt to be the sphere in which we would have experiences together, and the result is that we have no common experiences except our background. We live our background. Our house is our two generations of money flowing into more of culture. This is no way to live. But the fault is all in me and not in the environment. There is nothing else I want to do, nowhere else I want to live, no other woman I want to marry, no other background I want to accumulate. No, I must attack my own spirit to find and cure. I cause my own sterility. I make myself into a pompous ass. My own horizons, I must expand myself. My garden is smaller than Emily Dickinson's, although I am not a recluse. Perhaps I should retire to the porch until I no longer shyly shrink from contact, obstinately refuse diversion, stupidly escape from what and into what I don't know. More likely, I should practice each day going forth to live. I didn't set out to write an exposé of my family or my father. I was not motivated by bitterness or sentimentality, neither of which I feel. I sensed there was a story to be told, perhaps with a meaning that might go well beyond Ardrossan or southeastern Pennsylvania. I applied the tools at my disposal, a journalist's and a child's curiosity, a collection of papers, which often might lead to other papers, and an ability to ask questions, which I might try out on my family. The deeper I got, the more complex the story became, at which point it seems to me I had three options. I could abandon the project for fear of offending people who I loved. I could sanitize the most difficult parts. Or I could plunge ahead and try to do justice to the human complexities of the characters and the story. I guess you know I chose the third. My explorations led me deep into the history of Philadelphia and its suburbs, to the rise and later fall of the Pennsylvania Railroad, to the development of the Main Line, to the career of the Gilded Age architect Horace Trumbauer, to the eventual waning of power in the city of the old Protestant patricians, and the rise of new economic and social elites. It became possible, gradually, for me to begin to piece together how my father's forebears accumulated the wealth that enabled his grandparents to build Ardrossan, and how they and their descendants preserved, sometimes augmented, sometimes squandered, that wealth in the century that followed. The trail led me deep into the muffled history of multi-generational alcoholism in some branches of my father's family. Also back into what his brother described as the wintry period in my father's childhood, when, with his parents busy with their own glamorous lives, my father would later claim, only half joking, that he'd spoken with an Irish accent till the age of 9, having been raised by Irish cooks and maids. The research led me, too, to the carefully covered up story of his paternal grandfather, the railroad baron's son, the athletic clubman, as a headline writer called him, summing up for his obituary his leisure-heavy and not exactly purposeful life. He was long said to have died heroically in France in World War I, but turned out, in fact, not to have been killed, but to have killed himself, under circumstances that the family carefully erased from the record, the details of which I discovered survived in a battered black suitcase full of letters in the basement of a house in Needham, Massachusetts. My father, I learned, had a strikingly precise diagnosis for whatever had ailed his grandfather Scott, whom he'd never known. My father had reason to believe, he told a cousin, that their grandfather had suffered from bipolar disease. In my father's own journals, I watched him track the fluctuations of his emotional state, periods of, it seems, anxiety and depression, for which, as far as I know, he never sought treatment. And in those diaries, I watched him track his drinking, which he makes clear he used from an early age, at least in part, for what he believed to be relief from his symptoms. What was striking in those pages was the apparent clarity with which he recognized early on and in private his demons, the way he documented the ebb and flow of his moods, the extent to which he acknowledged to himself alone that he had a drinking problem, and that while always denying the problem to us, he struggled with it privately, sporadically, conflictedly over decades before he finally evidently ceased that ambivalent struggle. As I put it in the book, it was as if in his journals he were performing exploratory surgery on his spirit, operating without the anesthetic of self-pity. His diagnosis was eloquent and damning, To me, it suggested at times a band of darkness verging on despair. I called the book The Beneficiary because the deeper I got into it, the more I thought about the ambiguities of inheritance: land, houses, money, values, genes. On one level, an inheritance might be seen as simply an excess of good fortune, unequally distributed. On another, it informs major life decisions in ways its beneficiaries may recognize only too late. I also found myself thinking about the similarities between the ways my father's family made, sometimes squandered, but also preserved their fortunes over the 20th century, and what a new generation, here and elsewhere, is doing today. Do they ever wonder, I wondered, how it will all play out 100 years hence? Thank you.
Jenny let me know when she got here that although she is speaking everywhere, she is giving a slightly different talk, and I hope we all appreciate what insightfulness and care she shared with us tonight. Before we open up for time for questions and answers, I wanted to remind you that following this, there will be an opportunity to buy books and to have your book sold, if you brought it with you, in the library, along with a reception, which I hope you will come and join us for. And to remind you that next week, our next program will be with Scott Moore talking about hydropolitics and climate change and Philadelphia and its history as part of that story. At this time, I'd like to invite Jenny back up and open up for questions and answers. Just repeat the question.
Yes, I will. Anybody have any questions? Yes. Yes, absolutely. Did everyone hear the question? I'm going to paraphrase, correct me if I get it wrong, but at what point does a writer have the perspective, feel they have the perspective to write about their family, and how long did it take me to feel I got to a point where I was qualified to do this or where I was able to do it?
Had the right perspective.
You know, I think probably if one does this and then looks at it 5 years from now or 10 years from now or 15 years, your perspective is constantly in a state of flux. And so the book that I published in 2019 might not be the book I would publish in 2025, or certainly not what I would have published in 1985. It took me a very long time. I was skeptical of the undertaking, but tempted from the very beginning. I knew that there was really interesting material and characters, but I was a journalist, and I'd only written one book that was basically a lot like journalism, and I knew this was going to be very different, and a lot of what would be essential to get was the proper tone, which I think is a matter of perspective. So I can't say I have that perspective now, or that I, you know, would have it in 10 years. I feel that it, I mean, it took me about 6 years to do this. When I embarked upon it, I just started doing the research. I talked to my agent about it, and he said, this is not the kind of book that you want to tell a publisher about until you know exactly where you're going. So I spent several years doing the research, and then I got to a point where I really needed to write. So I wrote the first chapter, which took me 6 months to write 9,000 words, which was, again, about the struggle to find the right tone. And for me, the tone is not just a matter of style, it's a matter of finding a voice that is both, I would hope, affectionate and loving, but also with a kind of distance, a journalist's distance, so that I was not, as I said in the talk, sentimentalizing or romanticizing, but I also was not trying to tear the lid off the story, you know. And that was an incredible challenge. So I guess my answer to you is, I'm assuming it varies for everyone, and whether we ever have the perspective to write about our family, I don't know, but people rashly do it. Thank you very much. Anyone else? Yes. Yes. My mother is alive. I sent her the manuscript right before I submitted it to, I mean, the I already had a contract, but I submitted the on deadline to the publisher. And she, her first reaction, having, she, I didn't talk to her a couple days, and she called me back and she said, it's so sad, which it is. It's a very, it's sadder than I think would have anticipated when I embarked upon it. She read it again without, you know, and then told me that she had read it again and that she liked it even better. She had no complaints about anything except a single statement that my father had said about her that's quoted, that is, she felt a little unfair, but she never asked me to remove it, and it was out of the diaries. And she's read it a third time. She's enormously supportive. What she really thinks, my mother is much too wise, probably, to let on. So I can't tell you what she really thinks. I can only tell you that she's been a mensch about it. Yes. No. Actually, when I first found that one that I read from, I was so amazed by it. I scanned some of it and sent it to my siblings. And it precipitated some very interesting reordering of the way people thought, particularly the eldest sibling, thought about what went on in her earliest years. Thinking gave her insight into what was happening in our parents' marriage that shed, for her, shed light, she felt shed light on things that she attributed to other forces at that time. So it was, they were the only people who'd seen any of it. My mother, I found the diaries, I told her about them, I piled them up on the kitchen table and said, would you mind if I take them to New York? And she said, no, no. And she flipped one open and said, I remember that party, but that was it. No interest in reading them. And, you know, my parents were divorced for a long time. And so I think, getting back to the question you asked me before, my mother finds that it stirs up a lot of not necessarily happy memories. Yes. What are the plans for the property? Sorry, I should be repeating this. As you probably know, as of a couple years, some years ago, there were only 330 acres left. There had been a sale in the 90s and the early 2000s, and there was development of large houses and large lots. And now the remaining, almost everything except for the house and 10 acres, are being sold in a series of a five-phase series of sales, and some of it, part of it, 80 acres or so, I think, was sold to the township for preservation, as for conservation land, which is adjacent to another piece of land, Skunk Hollow, that was sold to the township back in the 60s. And then the rest of it is in the various stages of being developed with still large houses on slightly less large lots with a some sort of what in the real estate world seems to be called a view shed, some open space that is shared by those people moving into those houses. What will remain is the house and 10 acres, as I said, and the family is not determined what will happen to that. It's no longer in the trust that it was originally in, and so it's now owned by a 501c3 that's managed by the family, mainly, I would say, as a holding action till they can figure out if it could be preserved and in a way that wouldn't provide an ongoing huge financial burden. So it's up in the air. Yes.
Jenny, I think I'm the guest that you sort of presented as a failure, and I, from my perspective, you can see your
role. Thank you for saying that. I don't believe I presented him as a failure, and I don't think too many people who've read the book would say that. In fact, people who didn't know him, and maybe that's a different group, often react by saying, what a fantastic person. You know, people have said to me, I fell in love with your father. But I don't think that's necessarily the reaction of people who knew him. Invariably, one sees things differently. And I tried to state as a given some of the things you alluded to, definitely not in the kind of detail you might you might want, not because I was trying to give him short shrift, but I was really writing a different kind of book. And some people have said, including one relative, you know, I wish you had devoted much more time to attention to his what he accomplished at the museum. That is a different book, and it's not the book I sold, and it's not the book I wanted to write, and I think it would have been even hard as a child of that person to go out and report that story and ask people to speak honestly to me about that. But so I, as I say, my only defense would be I tried to lay those facts down and go from there, but it was it's a personal story about a whole other part of his life. But I appreciate your making that statement, and I think you're... That's very interesting that you say that. She's saying that she feels that some of the reviews have been in her, she hasn't read the book yet, but based on what I've said tonight, unfair to me and him in focusing on what she described as some of the more salacious aspects. I personally was blown away by the reviews. They were all incredibly positive, and possibly they have a bias, some of them, a bias in favor of things that jumped out at them. But I don't feel mistreated in any way by those reviews. I thought they were enormously sophisticated. It was reviewed by the New York Times, the Atlantic, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New Yorker. I mean, and they all took it very seriously. And I feel like, yes, they probably focused, they didn't fail to mention that my father was an alcoholic, but that is a central part of the story. So I don't feel in any way wronged by the reviews, and I don't think reviewers are trying to help you sell your books. Anybody else? Yes. Yes, that's not too personal. Absolutely. I mean, especially as an adolescent. I wouldn't say, well, even later too. I mean, I think I was very close to my father in a strange sort of way, for a person who in some ways it would be hard to get close to. But I think we had similar qualities, and we both appreciated those qualities in each other, but also they grated on us. So yes, when I was a teenager, we had a lot of arguments, and when I was in college, and yet I was the one who really, you know, tried to get close to him as an adult. I went on those bike trips with him, as my brother did too, but I did more of that. So if there's any suggestion that I do this as an act of revenge, it's absolutely not true. I adored my father, and I was fascinated by him, and I tried to sort of puzzle out what was really going on. But it wasn't out of any, as far as I know, in myself, any desire to hurt him posthumously. No, lest anyone else think that. Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. My brother, when he read the manuscript before, he and my sister also read it when I gave it to my mother, he said, don't you think you should say you were his favorite? So I was able to put it in by saying, my brother said. Yes. Yes. My interactions? Huge, huge. I grew up, you know, two doors away from her. I knew her until, she died in 94 or 95, and I was 40. So yeah, I had 40 years of experience with her. I mean, everybody knows the myth. incredibly interesting, funny, sharp in a lot of ways. Colorful. You really felt as a grandchild that you wanted to perform a bit for her. You felt it was, that's what was rewarded. If you could tell a funny story, if you could make her laugh, just a fantastic character. As somebody asked me this at another talk, and I said, rashly, not knowing that there was a reporter in the room, I said, well, every grandchild had a different relationship with her. It was really, you know, it varied from the based on somewhat on the personality of the kid, I would say. But I think I had a pretty good, lively, fun relationship with her. I remember her as just an extraordinarily wonderful character, but tough. There's someone sitting right near you who had a wonderful quote in the book who said, "There's no one your grandmother didn't reduce to tears." So, yes. Well, are there lessons for the next generation, a takeaway for the next generation? I'm sorry, I'm doing a terrible job of repeating questions. I didn't write this as any kind of morality tale or with any kind of lesson in mind, but I would hope that it would, for the next generation, that the sort of biochemical history would be understood, the tendency toward addiction. And I also personally think that it raises interesting questions about the thing I mentioned toward the end, about how inheritances can play out in people's lives. And I would not argue for, 100% estate tax or anything like that, but I think a consciousness that all these wonderful things that are passed on can have more complicated ramifications than we necessarily think about. I think that's useful. I talk to my kids about that kind of thing a lot. And I think, you can't look at a history of a family that made wealth in the late 19th century, that acquired wealth in the late 19th century or even earlier, and not find instances of people not really finding their place, their work, whatever. And I think work is essential to people's identity and self and their ability to sort of live fully. And I think to the extent that inheritance undermines the drive to work or the motivation to get out there and support yourself. Those are things that I think are of interest to me in the story and that I hope my children get from it. And finally, the story of covering up the suicide, which obviously these things are not handled the same way now. I think there are other relatives in the family who also believe that it's very important that people understand that history is there. Yeah. I made it clear in the book that the generation ahead of my father, that generation, they all worked. Their father, my grandfather's father, the one who killed himself, did not work. He worked for 2 years, but otherwise didn't. And he vowed that his sons were going to work. So from then on, they did work. My grandfather was a stockbroker, quite successful. My uncle and my father both worked, until retirement. And they didn't make a fortune the way Robert Leeming Montgomery had made it. But as I said, a lot of that wealth that he made, and that much of it came from his wife's side, the Tyler side, was put into these trusts that, along with the real estate in the on Ardrossan, and it was set up in such a way that for a long time, rent from the houses was able to, according to my uncle, was able to support the expenses of the place, and then the dairy was not in some ways, at a certain point, a vanity project for my grandmother. It was, as my uncle pointed out to her toward the end of her life, she was spending $3 for every dollar of milk that they could sell. And she said, "Well, if I get it down to $2.50, can I keep going?" So I think smart management and trusts that went on for a long time, and then, people making perfectly reasonable regular income. So the notion that they didn't work mostly is not true.
Could you just comment on that?
Yeah. My editor would tell you there are far too many names in this book. It was burdened by this family in which everyone was named the same thing. There are four Edgars and lots and lots of Hopes. So there was a real effort on the part of my editor to get me to make clear who the main characters were and not to clutter it up with other names of people who would surface once and then disappear. For Philadelphia readers, I think that's confusing because everybody knows what I'm talking about. But the idea was not that the book would only be read in Philadelphia. So early on, I got a call or an email from someone, or maybe it was at a talk, and someone said, "Why didn't you name Old St. David's Church? It was so clear that that's where that first scene was set." Well, I didn't name it, but I described exactly what it was and the history of it, which to me was more important. There seems to be a conspiracy theory in Philadelphia that I somehow left out Ann Darnancourt's name as a slight, which was absolutely not true. It's just that there were so many names, and it was an attempt to, I guess, to make the story feel more universal, less than particular. Yeah, I know. I mean, if you put in Walter Annenberg in the two times that he shows up in the book, it sounds a little kind of name-droppy or something. So it just felt to me like the right decision. Great, thank you very much. Okay, I guess that's it. Thank you.